So our next topic here is systemic mastocytosis and myelofibrosis from the Florida Cancer Specialist. We have back Dr. Mayan Hussain from the Villages. Mayan participated in our breast cancer session yesterday. Dr. Prithvi Bose from the MD Anderson Cancer Center and Dr. Andrew Kirkendall from the Moffitt Cancer Center. And Andrew, good to see you. I was wondering whether you're going to get here or not, but I guess your flight got canceled. But
we're here.
You're here.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Always exciting to hear when that happens. So we're going to start out and review systemic mastocytosis. I think I certainly could. I'm interested to learn more about it. I'm really happy that Mayan actually has a patient to present, and we'll get to that in a second. But Prithvi, let's talk a little bit about the data.
Thanks for having me, Neil. Yes, sure. So we'll get into the SM quick overview here. Lot to say, but we'll just make kind of hit the highlights. So the diagnosis, remember, you do need those aggregates. They have to be, just the presence of mast cells or increased mast cells in the GI tract, for example, does not make it SM. This is a common thing that comes up. They have to be in those multifocal aggregates. And then there are other criteria, as you can see. Most patients have indolent disease. Very few have smoldering disease. And then you have advanced disease, which unfortunately does significantly limit life expectancy. Indolent usually does not. And how do we distinguish between these things? B findings and C findings. So they're all listed here. But essentially, the idea being that B findings represent the burden of the disease without organ damage, whereas the C findings are, C for need for cytoreduction. So there you've actually got organ damage from the infiltrating mast cells, whereas the B findings are just high burden, but not yet any damage. Note that the KIT VAF is now considered a B finding because over 10% represents a high burden of disease. Driver mutation in most patients is KIT D816V. This is exon 17. There are a few similar mutations in the KIT gene, but vast majority are this one. And of course, we are now in the era of very precisely targeted therapies for this particular mutation. Avapritinib was approved for advanced SM in 2021 and then for indolent SM in 2023. As you can see here, if you look at the kinomes, especially with in contrast to the other approved drug, midostaurin, which is approved for advanced only, avapritinib clearly has a much cleaner kinome. So there were these studies, Explorer and Pathfinder. This is too rare a disease to do phase 3 trials in. So the pivotal trials were phase 1 and phase 2. Well, the pivotal was the phase 2. So you see the general design here. The dose, the approved dose of avapritinib is 200 milligrams starting dose daily. And that was what most patients in the phase 2 Pathfinder trial got. Now, what was striking about these trials was that the response rate was identical at 75% in both of these trials, at least in the interim analysis of the Pathfinder at 32 patients was the exact same, 75%, just like in Explorer. Now, here is a breakdown of these response rates. So again, 75% overall response rate. Something you do not see much with midostaurin is this high rate of complete response or complete response with partial hematologic recovery. That was 36%. So clearly, some deep responses here. Quick responses as well. 2 months median time to response, and then about eight or 9 months to a CR. Also, towards the right of the slide, you see we have the sort of the breakdown in terms of midostaurin exposed and midostaurin naive, and you see that clearly activity of avapritinib is retained regardless of prior midostaurin. And the molecular remission, right, something we don't see, for example, with our JAK inhibitors in MPNs, you really see deep remissions here. So with a level of detection of 0.17%, 30% of patients with a molecular remission of the KIT D816V. Survival, 46.9 months median, so a lot better than historically expected for these cohorts, and not reached for the aggressive SM and the mast cell leukemia, but 46.9 in the SM-AHN, which is by far the majority of the cases of advanced SM. And this is the phase two pathfinder. Now, this is 3 years of follow-up, and look at that response rate, still 73%. So a lot more patients than the interim analysis that was 32 patients, 83 evaluable here, still a very respectable 73%, and similar rates of CR and time to response, et cetera, as we talked about earlier. And then the molecular response at the bottom. So again, median overall survival not reached in Pathfinder, the phase two study, regardless of which subtype you look at of the advanced SM. This is markers of disease burden. So we looked at response criteria, which are more clinical, right? And now we have disease burden. So you can see here from these waterfall plots from both Explorer and Pathfinder that really profound reductions in bone marrow mast cells, serum tryptase, and KIT VAF, as well as spleen. Now, moving on to indolent SM, remember, it is approved for indolent as well. That was 2023. This is a much bigger proportion of patients. Generally, normal life expectancy, and the idea is to primarily to ameliorate symptoms. So this was the design, placebo-controlled phase three in this case, and this was the primary endpoint, the absolute change in the mean total symptom score, and that was met by avapritinib. Now, numerically, not a huge difference there, 15 versus 9, but clearly as you treat these patients for longer periods, you see the responses deepening. And this is individual symptoms, which is often more important than the aggregate because, each patient may be bothered by something different. And so you see that all of these go down. And these were the more conventional endpoints that the trial was initially designed to meet, TSS-30 and TSS-50, more familiar to us MPN folks, where you're looking at the percentage of patients that achieve a 30% or 50% reduction in total symptom score, and those were met as well. This is tryptase, so marked reduction in tryptase, and that was sustained, as well as KIT VAF. Now, bezuclastinib is from Cogent. This, at least according to the kinome presented here, appears to be an even cleaner drug in terms of the off-target kinases and thereby minimizing off-target toxicity. As you can see, PDGFR, for example, really not hit by bezuclastinib. They have completed enrollment considerably ahead of schedule to the SUMMIT study, which is their pivotal trial in indolent and smoldering SM. So again, initially a dose-finding portion and then the randomized portion. These are results, early results. We do not have the results from the larger randomized portion, but we have results from the part one. And so again, a very robust decrease in tryptase on this slide, and then symptom severity. Now, one quirk in this field is that every company, every drug actually has a different, slightly different symptom score, and that's just because they are proprietary. This is a little bit different in MPNs, but here the symptom scores that each product has used are a little different. And then this is waterfall plots, again showing you that 30% and 50% reduction in symptoms that clearly most patients achieve. And this is individual symptoms like we showed with avapritinib. And then this drug also has a separate trial in advanced SM that's called APEX. And here, just quickly show you the responses, numerical a little bit lower than we saw with avapritinib. Remember, we were talking 73, 75. So here is 52, but it's a smaller number of patients. We'll see what happens with this. And these are, again, profound reductions in disease burden. So important point here, there's clinical responses like I just showed you, and then there is markers of disease burden. So here you're seeing the target is being hit and those mast cells are being killed, depleted. But again, numerically across trials, lower response rates for the advanced setting with this drug. But no PFS and OS not reached. duration of response not reached. Now, finally, I'll finish with elenestinib. This is also from Blueprint, the makers of avapritinib. And so again, like bezuclastinib, this one does not penetrate the blood-brain barrier and also is considered to be more selective for the target, for the D816V. One of the issues with avapritinib in the advanced setting was the occurrence of cognitive side effects and intracranial bleeds. And so it was thought that development of drugs that do not cross the blood-brain barrier would be a good thing. Obviously, you could also argue, what does that mean for the brain fog that these patients have? If you don't penetrate the blood-brain barrier, are you going to make that better? I don't think we know those things yet. But this has been studied in indolent SM. This is the part one, just the dose-finding portion. They saw, essentially, at all their doses, they saw reductions in tryptase, KIT variant allele fraction, and bone marrow mass cells. So again, those markers of disease burden, and they saw responses in the symptoms as well. And I will end there.
So Andrew, maybe you can try to begin to put this a little bit in context, particularly in terms of these two other drugs that are coming along after avapritinib, bezuclastinib, and then elenestinib, in terms of at this point how you indirectly compare the three agents, and also what kind of tolerabilities. Prithvi was talking about brain fog, but what kind of tolerability issues come up?
Yeah, so with avapritinib, obviously approved for advanced and indolent systemic mastocytosis, and it's a very potent drug as far as we know. It hits the target, it reduces tryptase levels, lowers mast cell burdens in the bone marrow, lowers KIT D816V allele burden. So definitely hitting the target from that standpoint, leading to responses. I think the biggest issue with avapritinib is, one, it really isn't recommended to be used in patients with a platelet count less than 50,000. I think that's a big issue because most of the patients with advanced SM, speaking specifically for advanced SM, have SMAHN, so an associated hematologic neoplasm. Typically, that's myeloid in nature. Oftentimes, that's chronic myelomonocytic leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome, and that comes with some degree of cytopenias. And so the reason why patients can't be used, or why it's not recommended to use in patients with less than 50,000 platelets, is there was this concern during the development of avapritinib, not just in mastocytosis, but also in GIST, that there could be intracranial hemorrhages. And so these were seen in the development in GIST, higher doses, 300 milligrams there, and also seen early on in the development of avapritinib in advanced SM, but the protocol was amended to not allow use in less than 50,000 platelets, and so it's really recommended to be given higher than that. So despite it being a very effective drug, there's this concern that in patients who have cytopenias, it might induce some brain bleeding, and that's difficult for both physicians and patients to hear that as a side effect. So that combined with the cognitive effects that Prithvi alluded to, there is some, I think, advantages that could come with newer agents that may limit some of that toxicity profile. And so I think there's room for newer KIT inhibitors that can match avapritinib on potency, but may lack some of those toxicity concerns that kind of inhibit some of the I guess optimism we have using avapritinib. Certainly, we didn't see brain bleeding in the Pioneer and the indolent SM population, but still, if patients often go online and Google these drugs, right? If they see that that's associated with it at any point, there's some hesitancy on that end of things.
Prithvi, what do you do in patients who do develop cognitive impairment, and then how do you manage patients with thrombocytopenia?
Yeah, so the cognitive, that can be a really difficult side effect, but thankfully really seen at, like Andrew mentioned, at the high doses we use in advanced, right? At the 25 milligram, just to be clear for everyone here, at the 25 milligram we use in ISM, there's really almost no toxicity. So the advanced, 200, yes, I have seen that, and, essentially stop the drug. I mean, or maybe rechallenge at a lower dose, and that is a concerning side effect when it develops. And then thrombocytopenia, on the trial we were even using romiplostim, but again, obviously that is not an approved indication for a TPO-mimetic. But this avoidance of the less than 50, like Andrew mentioned, has really cleaned up that intracranial bleed concern. In Pathfinder, it was way less than in Explorer because of that being implemented.
All right, let's see how this plays out in the so-called real world. Mayan, how about your 62-year-old woman?
Yeah, so this is a 60-year-old lady who's been dealing with skin rash since 2013, been going to dermatologists for almost like 5 years, getting all kind of ointments, phototherapy, and then finally she started having some GI symptoms like diarrhea, bloating, and she was referred to a tertiary center. So they did EGD and colonoscopy. They didn't find anything significant, but they did biopsy it, and that's actually when they found mast cell aggregates, and they did the molecular testing and found the KIT mutation. So she did go through a bone marrow biopsy, and it was negative, the bone marrow biopsy. She was started imatinib. She got it for almost like 6 months without any response. So she was switched to Mido, and then she had relief of the GI symptoms, but the skin rash persisted. And then finally, she was started on AVA. And actually, she had complete response. She had repeat colonoscopy, took biopsies, was negative. But because of brain fog and some side effects, actually, she's currently on 50 milligram a day. And she's still totally asymptomatic with surveillance. Kind of, they're doing colonoscopy, just to make sure, and it's still negative. So she's doing good on that dose, and you worry about the low dose. So I guess beside the clinical symptoms, can you continue to watch for the mutation in the blood? What other ways you can, like, just to see if there is like an early recurrence, and can you stop the medicine? Is it possible just to...
Prithvi?
Sure. So a lot of, aspects to that case. So a couple of comments. So one, imatinib is unable to bind to KIT D816V. So imatinib has no role when D816V is present, and that's actually its label, that you can only use it with when there is not that mutation. But this case, my main question is this indolent? Because if it's indolent, then, you're really not, for the most part, worried about life expectancy. You're managing symptoms. So it didn't sound like to me that there was a C finding or anything that would classify it as advanced.
No, just a B. You're right. Yeah, so just this, but the skin rash was an issue. That was the main issue, and now it's gone with the AVA. So the
right. So 25 is the approved dose of AVA for indolent, 200 for advanced. Huge difference there. So 25, 50. Sometimes we go up to 50 if 25 is not enough. So there, the concern for toxicity is way lower. So I'm presuming maybe this patient was started at a higher dose and had the brain fog, etc., which we can see the cognitive effects at higher doses. But I would manage them long term with 25 or 50.
50, yeah.
Andrew, any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Prithvi. I think the dosing is really key here. I think oftentimes patients, just because they have a lot of symptoms, doesn't mean they have advanced disease. I try to reclassify as many patients as possible with indolent disease to allow for getting away with lower doses. And GI symptoms, skin symptoms, are more common in indolent disease, right. And they respond really, really, really well to low dose avapritinib. So sometimes you do need the 50 even in indolent disease. I think that you start at 25, and sometimes you can move up to 50, but somewhere in there you can get away with the low doses.
Prithvi, can you talk a little bit more about the brain fog in terms of qualitatively what patients say to you?
Yeah, so I think, and what I was, I alluded to this briefly as I was going through bezuclastinib and elenestinib, which do not penetrate the blood-brain barrier, right? So you think that's a good thing because, you're not going to have the cognitive side effects and intracranial bleeds, but then the disease can cause brain fog. And you wonder if you need to penetrate the blood-brain barrier to address that. This is actually very controversial. We don't know why SM patients have brain fog. Is it mast cells in the brain? Is it cytokines? We don't really know that. But it's important to recognize that the disease itself causes brain fog, and it's in all these questionnaires that the various studies are using. So I agree that in the advanced setting, there is absolutely an advantage to not crossing the blood-brain barrier because, there you worry about the intracranial bleeds and cognitive toxicity. But in the indolent setting, where you're only using a non-toxic dose of avapritinib, I think it's a different question. And we'll see, as the results of bezuclastinib, elenestinib mature, really where we stand with regards to symptom relief.
So again, Andrew, obviously we hear about fatigue, but insomnia, et cetera. But like, what do these people actually say in terms of, quote, brain fog? Is it continuous?
I think the biggest thing is it's hard for them to put their words on how they're able to describe that, but they can clearly say that they operate at a different level than they used to. And I think that's the biggest thing that they notice is they're not able to kind of do the things that they used to do. A lot of times it's, I was functional, I was working, I honestly can't do the tasks at work that I used to be able to do. And a lot of time I was a CPA, I was high functioning, I was doing this, that, and the other. And now I'm not able to keep up with that. I've had to take a lesser role. I've had to take time off. And so even though it's hard to put words on, you just feel like you're not operating. You're operating at 40%, 50% of what you used to be able to do.
Prithvi, any comments in terms of delay in diagnosis here? Obviously, this is not something people typically think about. It sounds like this woman bounced around a lot. I imagine you see that a lot.
Yes. So one of my patients, I think 15 years.
Wow.
She was, you know, essentially looking for a diagnosis. So, yeah, because, you know, they're so non-specific, right? That the symptoms are, you know, I mean, skin, GI, CNS, musculoskeletal. I mean, they may appear unrelated, right? So I completely agree that, you know, of course, the consciousness is, the awareness is all, you know, greatly increasing now in this era of really, really well-targeted therapies. But absolutely, I think the main problem is that it is so multifaceted. It's sort of diffuse in terms of its presentation.
Yeah, I got to say, this is the first time we ever covered this topic as a CME group, so I'm thrilled, you know, thinking about these people who actually don't even get a diagnosis. All right, man, let's hear about your 72-year-old man.
This guy's straightforward. 72-year-old, he did not have skin or GI symptoms, but he did have leukocytosis and thrombocytosis. So he had fatigue, weight loss, elevated white count. They scanned him, and they found that he has lymphadenopathy, so he had large lymph nodes, large spleen. So he had a bone marrow biopsy done, and actually that did show systemic mastocytosis with a mutation. So he was started on AVA, and actually his spleen regressed, his symptoms improved, and now he's actually almost in the pancytopenia stage. He's at 200 BID, so is that someone that you try to like play with the dose just to make sure he does, or you just, if he's not symptomatic with his pancytopenia, would you just maintain? Of course, you want to make sure the platelets are over 50,000. But
yeah, so this one is more tricky, and it does sound like advanced,
yes,
right? They saw organomegaly, lymphadenopathy. Although, again, you do need to look for organ damage. But let's just assume this is advanced, and that is where we start with 200, right?
Right.
Which is what they're on. In my experience, that's a tough dose to tolerate. I mean, 200 of AVA is difficult from the point of view of those cognitive effects particularly. And then, again, you can be careful about the platelets, right? You can probably minimize the intracranial bleeds. I don't think that's a huge issue anymore. But then the cognitive is hard to get away from. So this is where I think I would have a lot of optimism for the newer agents. But until we have them, I think 100 a day is what I would suggest.
So cut him down to 100, provided his symptoms don't come back.
Right, yeah. Right. But then with advanced, you always are worried about survival. So
yeah,
there is that aspect. And stem cell transplant, for example, can be considered.
I mean, he's 72, so he's probably not at transplant.
Andrew, anything you add to that?
I mean, the one thing I would say is certainly keep an eye out for an associated hematologic neoplasm there, especially with the pancytopenia. Certainly, avapritinib can cause cytopenias, but so could some underlying CMML or something that may progress.
So I think repeat the marrow, maybe, like do another bone marrow.
Correct. And NGS panels can help there,
okay,
as well, right? If you see kind of KIT mutations, but also TET2, SRSF2, that could symbolize that there's something else going on. I think one thing to kind of hit on is we know that patients who are on avapritinib, they will keep control of their mast cell component. The one way in which their disease often progresses is from the non-mast cell component. So the CMML can often progress to AML or something more severe, and you may have to switch therapies then to focus on the AHN component of the disease as well.
Thank you.
So Maya, when you wrote up the case, you brought up the issue and question of when do you suspect SM?
Yeah.
Anything you want to elaborate on?
Just because this patient didn't have GI or skin symptoms, and and sometimes you worry, should I marrow him? Should I just biopsy a lymph node? And just like you guys said, it's most of the symptoms are generic. They're not specific for the disease.
Yeah, this could have been anything. I mean,
right,
until
yeah,
the biopsy. Yeah.
Yeah. So the question is, there's anything that alarms you? Say, you know what? Maybe we should look for. Maybe we should do a colonoscopy, endoscopy, even if they don't have symptoms, to see if they have the mast cytopenia.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tissue biopsy, right? So seeing mast cells somewhere is good. I mean, tryptase is a really simple test to send off, and that's you know, used in the diagnostic criteria, and something that if it comes back very high can symbolize this is going on. And nowadays, NGS panels a lot of times will alert us, even though they're not as sensitive as we'd like them to be for some of these mutations. If you get an NGS and you're working up a CMML or MDS, and lo and behold, they have a KIT mutation at 8%, you know, you oftentimes are calling back to the pathologist and saying, hey, do you mind looking in there and see if they have any?
And then they can look for them. And, Thank you.
All right, let's talk a little bit about myelofibrosis. Andrew.
All right, sounds good. So shifting gears a bit to talk about myelofibrosis. So really just going to review where we're at now in the era of four approved JAK inhibitors. Here are my disclosures. So kind of zeroing things out, let's go back and talk a little bit about ruxolitinib. So approved in 2011, based on its ability to drastically improve proliferative symptoms and signs of this disease. So it improves spleen volume, symptoms. It's also been associated with a survival benefit. You can see here these kind of stark waterfall plots showing the vast majority of patients having improvement in their spleen, substantial improvement compared to the natural history of the disease, which would be to have kind of progressive enlargement of the spleen over time. Focusing on symptoms, you can see here these orange bars representing symptom improvement with ruxolitinib, regardless of which symptom we're talking about. These could be spleen-related symptoms, cytokine-related symptoms, fatigue, even bone or muscle pain, all of these things improving compared to what we see on the natural history of the disease, which is symptoms tend to get worse over time. And I think encouragingly, these symptoms, it's important to show kind of as a feature of time, these symptoms improve rapidly. If you've had patients you've treated with ruxolitinib, you know that oftentimes they'll talk about feeling better within days of starting the medication, especially if they have these drastic proliferative symptoms. And as I alluded to before, there is a survival benefit seen with ruxolitinib in patients with higher risk myelofibrosis who met the criteria to go on the COMFORT study. And you know, this is something that sometimes gets overlooked because ruxolitinib is not getting rid of the disease, but it is something that can really meaningfully impact a patient's experience with the disease. But ruxolitinib has downsides. We know that it causes myelosuppression, anemia, thrombocytopenia that limits dosing of the medication. Here, just showing kind of from some of the supplemental figures of the COMFORT trials, the rates of grade 3 and grade 4 anemia, thrombocytopenia with ruxolitinib. And even as a function of time, you can see that patients that were started at 20 milligrams twice a day, 15 milligrams twice a day in the dark green and light green arms, you know, that average dose goes down over time. Most of the patients who were on 20 twice a day end up on 15 twice a day. Most of the patients who start on 15 twice a day end up on 10 or less. And this is going to actually impact response rates. And we know it actually factors into overall survival expectations from the RR6 model, developed several years ago now, but looked at patients treated with ruxolitinib, looked at different factors of those patients at 6 months, or at baseline 3 months and 6 months, to see, can we identify patients who aren't going to do as well with ruxolitinib? And here, if you are requiring transfusions, if you don't have a substantial spleen volume reduction, if you're on doses lower than 20 milligrams twice a day, this predicts for a worse overall survival. And this may identify patients where we need to look for an alternative therapy or perhaps clinical trials. Fedratinib was our second approved JAK inhibitor with data that's largely mirrors what we saw with ruxolitinib. So drastic improvement in spleen volume reductions. I think if you're comparing across trials, not recommended to do, but we do it all the time. Fedratinib may show actually more potent suppression of spleen volumes, and it may be our most potent spleen volume reducer compared to all the other JAK inhibitors. Here approved for intermediate 2 and high risk disease in 2019. Also improves symptoms, very similar curves that we see compared to what we saw in the COMFORT studies. Here, we ignore that 500 milligram dose. That's not an approved dose. The approved dose is 400 milligrams daily of fedratinib. We have second-line data for fedratinib. So on the JAKARTA 2 study, this was a study done in patients that were relapse refractory or intolerant to ruxolitinib. Patients washed out of ruxolitinib for at least 2 weeks and then were put on fedratinib on a phase 2 second-line study and still saw drastic improvement in spleen and symptom responses. So really encouraging second-line data. This was largely recapitulated in the FREEDOM 2 study. Very similar patient population here, randomizing patients 2-to-1 to fedratinib or best available therapy. And again, we're seeing superiority with fedratinib in terms of spleen volume and symptom improvements in the second line setting. And so really that's kind of been the niche for fedratinib now is, you know, I think ruxolitinib is preferred in the frontline setting in the vast majority of patients, but fedratinib may have a role here as a second line agent after ruxolitinib failure or intolerance. Pacritinib is perhaps an accelerated approval for patients with platelets less than 50,000. This was an accelerated approval gained in February 2022. Pacritinib is a JAK2, FLT3, IRAK1, and ACVR1 inhibitor, largely approved based upon the PERSIST-2 study that interestingly enrolled patients with a platelet count less than 100,000. But here, patients were randomized to be on pacritinib versus best available therapy. And again, pacritinib showed superiority in terms of spleen and symptom responses in this thrombocytopenic patient population with myelofibrosis. The approval, accelerated approval, is really limited for the less than 50,000 patient population because that's the group of patients that really doesn't have the ability to be on Rux or fedratinib based on those patients not being enrolled on those studies. When you look at just kind of comparing pacritinib to ruxolitinib, as ruxolitinib was allowed as best available therapy, low-dose ruxolitinib, and you look at efficacy profile, trying to compare PAC to Rux in this thrombocytopenic patient population, pacritinib does better at spleen volume responses, symptom improvements, and this PGIC, patient's global impression of change, so overall just improvement there. And then that leads us to our fourth approved JAK inhibitor, which is momelotinib. Originally, momelotinib was compared head-to-head versus ruxolitinib in the Simplify 1 study. This was a non-inferiority study. Momelotinib was non-inferior to Rux in terms of spleen volume responses, but was not as good as ruxolitinib in terms of symptom improvement. I think largely this is what we're noticing in practice as well, as we've had access to these agents, that Rux is really the best symptom drug as far as patients feeling better with myelofibrosis. In the Simplify 2 study, this is a second-line study. Patients who'd been on ruxolitinib went on momelotinib. This was compared to best available therapy. Largely, patients on BAT just continued on ruxolitinib. This was a superiority study, and unfortunately, if you're on Rux and you stay on Rux, or if you're on Rux and you switch to momelotinib with no washout, there's really not much more spleen volume reduction you get. So this study failed in the sense that the primary endpoint was looking at spleen volume responses, which were rarely seen on either arm in this study. All that experience led into the Momentum study, which was a phase 3 study looking at patients with myelofibrosis, anemia, prior ruxolitinib use. They had to be symptomatic and have an enlarged spleen. They were randomized to be on momelotinib versus danazol, an active control that we do use for patients with anemia and myelofibrosis, but you needed an active control because you needed this to be a blinded study because the primary endpoint was a symptom response. Overall, this was a study that really built on the experience from Simplify 1, Simplify 2, and what it showed is that momelotinib is better than danazol at achieving symptom improvement in patients that met criteria to enroll on this study. And obviously, momelotinib as a JAK inhibitor was better at spleen volume responses as well. But really where we want to use momelotinib is in patients that have anemia, and here actually was quite encouraging that momelotinib was actually had better anemia responses in this patient population as well. Danazol is an active control. We use this for anemia. We expect responses to some degree. Here at baseline, 13%, 15% of patients were transfusion independent. At week 24, 30% were transfusion independent in the momelotinib arm versus just 20% in the danazol arm. So maybe a better anemia drug compared to danazol in this study. And when you look at the survival curve, you actually see a bit of a separation here between week 0 and 24 between momelotinib and danazol, but then that largely comes back together after patients go on open-label momelotinib. So patients went from danazol back on to momelotinib, and there you see the survival curves coming back together. Pacritinib, it's worth mentioning, is an ACVR1 inhibitor. I mentioned this after talking about pacritinib because this was really discovered after pacritinib studies were published. And momelotinib largely gains a lot of its press and excitement on its anemia benefits based on being able to inhibit ACVR1, but it turns out pacritinib can do that just as well, and maybe actually, at least in these assays, was a more potent ACVR1 inhibitor. So going back and rehashing and doing a retrospective review of the PERSIST-2 study, it turns out that pacritinib is also associated with some anemia benefits that may have been underappreciated in those studies. So here, TI conversion rate favoring pacritinib over best available therapy, and we also see reduction in transfusions, which favors pacritinib versus best available therapy as well. So this could also be an option in anemic patients with myelofibrosis, similar to what we use with momelotinib. largely, I would say that the approval of JAK inhibitors has not transformed the field, these newer JAK inhibitors, but it's allowed us to extend the percentage of patients that are able to benefit from JAK inhibition. Largely, this kind of red box was the patients that were able to be on JAK inhibitors, but with kind of early initiation, we've extended that a little bit earlier, and then with PAC and momelotinib being approved, we're able to kind of get more durable extension of JAK inhibitors, and so patients are able to achieve benefit for longer. Where are our unmet needs in myelofibrosis? I think we still need to do better at improving hematopoiesis, and we need to alter the natural history of disease, whether that's with combination therapy, direct targeting of these core driver mutations, or more comprehensive suppression of the JAK-STAT pathway. I think that's to be determined. We certainly have ongoing trials that are looking at this. We're certainly excited about the readout from luspatercept studies, elritercept. Elritercept and DISC-0974 are trying to leverage our understanding of anemia pathways. And then we have combination pathways or combination therapies that have completed trials and some that are actively in phase 3 trials. And I think the very exciting thing is direct targeting these core driver mutations, whether it's CALR or more specific JAK inhibitors that are actively in early phase trials right now.
So, Mayan, I know you have a couple of cases here, but any sort of general questions before we get into your cases, Mayan, that you think oncologists in practice have about MF? Mayan?
I think Roxo is definitely the fatigue part is important, because I remember when got approved, like that's, I had probably 10 patients within a year on Roxo, and the most common feedback was like, I feel better. Like, even if the numbers don't get better, they feel better. So what is your threshold to start it? Because I know sometimes fatigue is very relative. So like, and if the numbers are not that bad, like you might say, well, let's just do observation because they're asymptomatic. So what's the threshold that's, you know what, I'm going to go for it.
Prithvi?
So I'm increasingly starting Rux early. You know, of course it's great for symptoms, absolutely. Yeah. But also, there's a lot of data accumulating, probably more than we can discuss at this forum, but even from PV, from studies in early MF, there's a lot of data accumulating that Rux can perhaps be disease-modifying if you go in early with a reduction of the VAF and things like that. So I tend to start Rux if there is any appreciable splenomegaly.
Okay.
You know, I mean, yes, if somebody has no splenomegaly or symptoms, I'll probably watch them. But if there is, I tend to start.
How about with PV? Like, you start with phlebotomy probably if they're not symptomatic. But would you, if they're resistant phlebotomy, would you just go with Roxo or you would try hydroxyurea?
Okay, so my answer was strictly for MF.
Yeah.
But for PV, I do actually use it on label, which is I use it in hydroxyurea intolerant. Or resistant.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Andrew, anything you want to add to that?
I would add one thing. So, I mean, the survival benefit in a lot of the data with Rux is very good for patients that were able to be enrolled on the COMFORT studies. So they had to have splenomegaly, they had to have symptoms. I do tend to like starting it earlier. I think there's benefits to be gained in the right patient population. So patients that have some degree of proliferative symptoms or splenomegaly where you feel like you can actually get a benefit. I will mention your fatigue question is tricky though, because I would say fatigue is the one symptom that I've been less excited about its patient's response. So fatigue in the setting of fevers, chills, night sweats, bone pain, weight loss, like that tends to do well. Patients feel better. If they don't really have those other proliferative symptoms and they come in with just fatigue as being their main issue, I've been less excited about the responses I've got there. I think it can help in some patients, but I think there's still something we're missing with the fatigue that's not completely addressed by the ruxolitinib.
You know, Mayan, it's interesting you brought up your clinical experience when Rux became available, because I remember when it was the COMFORT data were first presented and we started to hear about these cases. And we have a bunch of fellows here today, you know, no experience with that. Can you kind of reflect back a little bit, Mayan, in terms of what you saw in your practice there, in terms of how it affected people's quality? I don't think there's ever been anything as dramatically, as quickly affect quality of life as this. What did you see there, Mayan?
I mean, that's one of the things that I really, like, you know, I had a kind of, because it was a new drug, I like to try new things. And it's like, you know, when they have symptoms, we try other things, like, okay, let's try this, and we get it. And that's really one of the most common feedbacks I got. Like, even if their numbers don't improve, maybe the spleen doesn't shrink much, but they still feel like, I do feel better. Because then we discuss, like, okay, it's not helping with your, like, clinical findings. Should we stop it? And it's like, no, but I do feel better. I'm doing more. I'm, like, you know, and I'm in a retirement community. So one of my quality of life measures is how many golf rounds are you doing a week? Like if they used to do like 9 holes once a week, now they're doing 18 holes twice a week. That's an improvement, and that's what I would see. So I feel like it does have that symptomatic relief.
Andrew, you kind of referred to it in your talk. Any thoughts about what's going on in these people who feel better and yet you don't really see any changes in the numbers?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, ruxolitinib is an incredible disease-specific anti-inflammatory medication. So I think it really hits on some of the cytokines that drive the symptoms of the disease. I think one of the reasons we see effects so rapidly, too, is that it has a short half-life, so 4.5-hour half-life. So I think that is able for patients to kind of, I mean, I've had patients say, like, within the first day that they take it, they're noticing changes as far as how they feel. But I think myelofibrosis is an inherently a molecularly complex disease. So you're usually not dealing with just a JAK2, just a CALR, or just a MPL mutation. Often they have ASXL1, SRSF2, splicing mutations, additional mutations. So these are complex diseases. And like we saw with avapritinib, you know, you can potently inhibit KIT, and if that's your only mutation, great. But with ruxolitinib, you're suppressing that JAK-STAT pathway, but usually there's other inflammatory pathways, other pathways that are that are implicated. So you're not seeing necessarily across the board, you know, improvement in the disease.
I mean, I had a patient who stayed on it for almost 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he had splenomegaly and it did shrink, and he actually died from like dementia and old age. He didn't die from the disease.
Oh, we definitely have some long-term responders to RUX. Yes.
My experience with the long-term responders are those the ones that typically just have one mutation, right? Like especially just the JAK2 mutation, or maybe maybe a TET2 or something like that in addition. But they don't have those other high-risk
not
mutations.
Not the molecular complex molecular.
And usually good counts.
Yeah.
Usually solid counts.
All right, man, 79-year-old man.
Yeah, that's a 79-year-old who actually was diagnosed at UPMC. He's a big Steelers fan from Pittsburgh. And he presented with splenomegaly, and then they did the workup, bone marrow biopsy, and he was found to have myelofibrosis. He had SFSR2, it was 46XY. So and he had IDH2 mutation. So they put him on a clinical trial. His spleen was really palpable, like you could feel it. That was around 17 centimeter. So he was on RUX and also one of the BCL2 inhibitors trial. And he actually had excellent response. His spleen went back to normal. His counts improved. His quality of life improved. He started to become an Eagles fan. I'm just kidding. So I want to say his mental status.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened is the trial, so he's been on it like almost 40 years now. We're into the fifth year. So the trial closed, and now they stopped providing the BCL2. So I kept him on RUX. And he's still doing good, almost a year now. The question is, how much should I be concerned that his response is... Because they told us he was on the medication, and they kept providing it after trial closed, but then they start that set, we're not providing anymore because I think they're waiting for FDA approval or something. So he's doing good, and I'm concerned, about... Is that response was because of the combination, or was it just because of the RUX? Should I just keep him? Should I try to find compassionate use for BCL2 inhibitor?
Andrew?
Well, yeah, so the trial that I believe you're referring to is the Transform 1 trial. So it was ruxolitinib plus navitoclax BCL2, BCL-XL. One of the combination, it's not on here in my combination slide because, the program's really been shelved. And it's unfortunate because it had positive data at ASH a year and a half ago, showing really doubling of spleen responses with the combination of navitoclax plus RUX. But the problem was the key secondary endpoint of symptom response was not seen. So it actually, symptoms were mildly worse, which with the combination, which I don't think should have been unexpected. You're combining an additional agent, comparing it to ruxolitinib alone. But we did see kind of a profound doubling of the spleen response. So we know this is a more potent agent. It had biologic rationale. I think that combination therapy is going to be required to get more comprehensive control of these diseases. We don't know what the right combination partner. I don't know if we know what the right endpoints are, for these clinical trials right now. But in that case, in that patient who has high-risk mutations, you do get concerned that maybe the navitoclax was playing a role with that profound kind of response that he got. But, I don't think that, my guess is you'd be able to keep him on ruxolitinib and kind of assess the spleen over time and see how he's feeling because, the reasonable question is, does it matter to shrink spleen a little bit bigger? Make, if the spleen goes down a little bit further, does that matter clinically? And I think that's on us as investigators in the field to prove that does matter or doesn't, and if not, create better endpoints.
And if you're worried about his molecular profile, enasidenib, if you can obtain it, would be a rational addition. Yeah. You mentioned IDH2.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
You see responses to IDH inhibitors?
So in accelerated and blast phase, which is really hard to treat, you absolutely do, and you have about 30% of patients have IDH mutations. Frankly, that's if you see that in the, you know, you feel like I can do something for this patient. So yes, you do see them in that. Now in chronic phase, we don't have data really to fall back on, but it makes sense, and these are well tolerated, the IDH inhibitors. So I mean, I've done it occasionally.
You see differentiation syndrome?
I haven't.
All right, let's finish out with this 80-year-old lady.
So this is very nice 80-year-old lady who actually has been seeing one of your colleagues. She actually had history of triple-negative breast cancer in 1995, so that's before I even finished medical school, and was diagnosed with ITP at that time, treated for ITP in like 2000, like in the early 2000s. And then 2015 started dropping her platelet again, so we did a bone marrow, and it was a hypercellular bone marrow, has moderate to severe fibrosis at this time, atypical megakaryocytes. So in 2020, her platelet continued to drop, and actually I did send her to Dr. Komrokji at Moffitt at that time, who recommended, okay, let's start thalidomide and prednisone. And she did not have any response. And then we put on Promacta, and she had it for almost like 6 months. Again, like maybe mild response, but not like didn't come back to normal. Anemia started getting worse, so he actually recommended danazol, just like the trial. And he had a repeat bone marrow, didn't show any response at that time. So finally, her platelet kept dropped below 50,000. So in 2022, we saw pactinib. And actually, she continues to be in pacrętinib till now. The platelets are still like close to 50, 60, but at least her anemia stabilized, no leukocytosis, and clinically she didn't have, like the spleen actually did regress in size. And now, you know, she used to be a twirler actually, and she continued to do that till just the last 2 years, and not because of the disease, it's because just she's like now 80 something. So that's the case. The question is, relationship between ITP, MF, you think it was maybe MF in the beginning when they diagnosed with ITP because of the low platelets?
Andrew?
And you could have some enlarged spleen at that time, yeah. And they think it's ITP.
So I've seen this relationship very commonly with CMML, so chronic myelomonocytic leukemia. Someone gets diagnosed with ITP, thrombocytopenia, may respond to IVIG or rituximab or various implications briefly, and then like 4 or 5 years later, for some reason, they come back in, and now we diagnose them with CMML. But I imagine the overlap can be, you know, I don't know if I fully understand why one gets diagnosed before the other, or if it's a harbinger of something to come. Yeah. You'd love to go back and like find a blood sample from then and run an NGS
like
panel
NGS at that time.
And see if there was anything present around then. My guess is there's some way that the two are related. We just don't fully understand it at this point in time. I don't know if you have.
No, I think, you know, we just don't know. It could have been MF the whole time,
yeah.
You know, because, you know, the driver mutations are actually acquired very early in life.
Yeah.
They've even been described to occur before birth. And it takes, there's a long latency before the disease develops. So, I mean, who knows when it really began, you know? This is best known for JAK2, but this is something.
The question was that if she was treated for MF at that time when they thought it's ITP, could that have made a difference?
I don't know about that. Yeah. I doubt it.
I wish we had that good of therapies that would have made a difference at that time, but I don't think that we did.
Thank you.
So somebody earlier today said this is the sonic oncology, you know? And we're going to keep going for the rest of the day. We're going to take a lunch break now. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you
very much.